68 men, William Prince of Orange, landed at Port Bay, which was then, we are told, a collection of fishing huts, now called Kings, Britain, etc., with a substantial army of Dutch, German, Scandinavian, and Scottish mercenaries. That was the beginning of what the Whig historians, and indeed until quite recent times, virtually all bourgeois historians, called the Glorious Revolution. Now, most of you, especially if you've been to Northern Ireland, will have seen King Billy, as he became, portrayed on his horse, sword in hand, in some versions waving his hat at the Battle of the Boyne, nearly 2 years later. He became the word orangeism, it comes from his title, the symbol of the most backward, reactionary attitudes. Yet, at the same time, if we look realistically at the events of 1688, we have to say, actually, this was the decisive culmination of the English bourgeois revolution. Now, I want to make 2 points about that. First of all, that view, which I believe to be entirely sound, is not shared by the vast majority of bourgeois historians today, nor by most of those historians who would call themselves Marxists. I will demonstrate later why they are wrong. Secondly, the consequence of their view for them, John Rees wrote an article in the current international socialist journal called, what is it? I've forgotten the damn title. Anyway, it's about the English Revolution and so on, and I read down a paragraph, the dates, key dates, 1660 to 1640 to 1660. And of course, he's reviewing a set of books, arguing about a set of books in Paris. Therefore, the events of 1688 seem as a sort of tailpiece, an incident, not of fundamental importance. Let me demonstrate, first of all, that that is a mistake. You see, wrong set of jokes. It is significant that the most important, greatest of the Whig historians of the last century, Macaulay, thought that 1688 was a decisive turning point, was of fundamental importance. He so thought that he wrote a book, his major work, it is called A History of England, which you might suppose might start with the Romans, or at least the Saxon invasions and so on. No, it starts effectively with the reign of King James II. In 1685, and after all, Macaulay was writing in the 1840s, you would have thought, what's happened since then? It finishes effectively in 1705. You know, the concentration, this is not because Macaulay was not an industrious man, far from it, and this is a massive work. The Everyman edition occupies 4 whole volumes. Why did he take that view? Because he was himself part of that Whig ascendancy which came out of the revolution of 1688, and because he was not an academic writing theses, he was an active politician writing to influence people. Remember, every serious historical work is a political statement. There is no such thing as neutral history. Why did Macaulay think it so important, and why do I? Because actually, in spite of the fact that there were much more exciting events at an earlier period, this was the decisive settlement. A settlement which lasted in form for 150 years and in practice for probably another 50, which takes us to the 1880s. And what a period! What 150 years! This was the period that saw the establishment of English maritime supremacy around the world. This, in competition with the Dutch, the French, and so on. This was the period that saw the conquest of India, the conquest of North America, the first British Empire, and so on. This was the period, as it went on, that saw the destruction of the English peasantry. To borrow Stalin's phrase, their liquidation as a class. except that the English Board was leading it much more thoroughly than Stalin did. There aren't any English peasants now, there's still some Russian ones. He also saw, and this is still more important, the world's first industrial revolution, with all the social, rapid social transformations that involved, all the upheavals, the stresses of the 1820s, the 1830s, and so on. This was achieved by a ruling class whose framework, and indeed to a large extent whose personnel in family terms, had been established in 1688. That's why the thing is important. Now, let us look at the events that had preceded them. That is to say, the events between 1640, meeting of the Long Parliament, and 1660, the restoration of the Stuart monarchy. You will be relieved to hear that I am not going to deal with this in detail, but I must say one thing and spend a little time on it before giving a brief and brutal resume of the course of events till the 1680s. That is this. You know, Marx writes somewhere about history being made and so on by classes, and he says, consciously indeed, but with a sort of false consciousness. That is to say, in class societies, previous class societies, the ideas in people's heads did indeed correspond in a sense to their interests, but expressed in veiled, concealed, ideological fashion. And in the 17th century Britain, it's too round the world, forget the world, in 17th century Britain, it was the case that the differing ideologies, or different variants of ideologies, were expressed in religious terms. Therefore, it is necessary to speak of three trends as an attempt to force compromise. First, we have the Roman Catholic, or to use the Protestant terminology of the day, the papists. They are not what they were then. Don't misunderstand. What the question is, what was the Roman Catholic Church then in the 17th century? It was essentially, in ideological terms and in alignment, the representative of feudal or quasi-feudal reaction. Every statement needs to be qualified. There are bits of the church in which this is not so. We'll talk about one of them, Ireland, in a little while. But essentially that was it. Therefore, in British, in terms of English and Scottish terms, that's the extreme right. And it represented the most backward sections of the landowning classes on which the monarchy sought to rest. Secondly, there was Presbyterian Calvinism, called in Britain the Presbyterian. Now, they don't have anything there, do they? And yet, at that time, Calvinism was the ideology of the relatively successful bourgeoisie. That is to say, of substantial merchants, including some very rich men, of the whole layer beneath them, of progressive, in quotes, landlords. I don't mean progressive in the sense that the Communist Party used to tell us about progressive capitalists. I mean progressive in the literal sense. Landlords who were innovating, landlords who invested to produce for a market, essentially market-oriented, capital accumulation-oriented. The ideology of Calvinism had been adapted, whatever its original form, into ways which suited better than any other the requirements of capital accumulation, and also provided a justification for political action. In particular, the whole notion of the elect, we are the pure selected few and all the rest are damned, therefore what we do is justified, it is God's will, and so on and so forth. Secondly, be frugal, abstain, work hard, drinking, dancing, fornication, all these things are evil. Let us understand, when I say in the 17th century people express their interest in religious terms, it's not a question of simply a counting hypocrite saying this in order that I could raise even more money. Well, had they been that, they would not have been formidable. No, no, they believed it. Then, there was what we call the Anabaptist tradition. This stood well to the left, represented basically the aspirations of small property owners. Now, we are so used to a society in which the majority of people are wage or salary earners, the vast majority are those or their families, that it is necessary to forcefully remind ourselves that the mass of the English and Scottish people, more of the Scots at that time, the poorest, not all of them, but the great majority were small property owners. The peasantry still existed, right? The peasantry had not been liquidated. But of course, their aspirations differed very, very considerably from that of the Presbyterians. They're called, English terms, English Revolution terms, independents. Having said all these things, let me have another qualification. Of course, the categories are not rigid. Many independents were Calvinists, right? As well. All sorts of things can be accommodated, you know, within things. But essentially, as events were to show, the notion of Baptist independence and so on, their ideal was a republic of small property owners. They represented the left in mass terms. I leave aside the level of reductionism. I leave aside figures, millennial sects and so on. I know they're very important in terms of what is to come a long time after. They were not important in terms of the immediate course of events. On the contrary, what the difference? Finally, we have the post-compromise. The Church of England as by law established. That is its official title. And the as by law established is the important thing. Remember, before 1640 and again after 1660, there was no religious tolerance. Everyone was supposed to belong to the state church. Indeed, there was legislation still on the statute book, although it's only enforced sporadically, that failure to attend religious service on Sunday could be punished by a fine of up to 1 shilling. 5p in those days, it was a lot of money. Why? You see, again, because ideologies expressed in religious terms, the preachers, priests, parsons, whatever, I mean, the essential ideological arm of the government. There are no newspapers worth talking about. There's certainly no CP. The means of hatred, see, at the disposal of our present ruling class did not then exist. Hence, overwhelming importance there of religious dissent. It seems incredible to us that, people should argue about religious differences to the point of killing one another on a large scale. We have to remember that this ideology, right, not only important for reasons of the past, but for reasons of the present. Now, the Church of England was also a battleground, precisely because it was the state church, and different emphases by different regimes led to different requirements and conflicts within it. It was not a homogeneous body. Indeed, it included people who were concealed papists or near papists on the one hand, and people who were, for all practical purposes, dyed-in-the-wool Calvinists on the other, and a whole mass in between. Balance emphasis shifting from side to side. Now we can get back to this. You must think that's an irrelevant digression, perhaps. It is not. It is an essential thing. 1640, because of a whole series of preceding events, the English bourgeoisie, that is to say the House of Commons, dominated. When I say the English bourgeoisie, I don't mean the majority of them were merchants, only a minority were. Both of the members of the House of Commons were medium-sized property owners. But they were market-oriented, embryonic developing capitalism, and they were Calvinists. Right? All the three things went together. Essentially, the monarchy, as it then existed, represented a compromise that had been established much earlier, going right back to Henry VIII, between the old society, which was in many ways an obstacle to capital accumulation, but it was all the whole mass of vestiges of the Middle Ages, and also much more recent innovations designed to preserve the peasantry, to prevent rapid capital accumulation, and so on and so forth. The monarchy had actually leaned on the bourgeoisie in the earlier period. Now the bourgeoisie had become strong enough to challenge it. And as usually happens, as numbers of people were concerned, they did not start with saying,
monarchy?
Oh, whether they're off with his head and so on. No, they started with a concrete argument about the subject which is the subject dearest of all to the hearts of bourgeoisies everywhere. Money. Money. The right of the House of Commons, in return for voting sums of money, to effectively determine his policy, the King's policy. As we know, this led to, and I said I've got to brutally compress the course of events here, ultimately the formation of two armed camps to the Civil War. Now then, all that we need to say about the Civil War here, although it's a very exciting subject, is that for the first years, the Presbyterian-dominated leadership of the House of Commons, most of the Lords had gone with the King, a minority with the Parliament, was reluctant to press things to extremes. Therefore, they fought in a very half-hearted way. They had overwhelming the economic resources of the country, the then economically developed parts of the country. Right? No question about it. They hesitated, and I've expressed this hesitation very well by an exchange between the general who the Presbyterian Parliament had appointed as the supreme then commander, the Earl of Manchester, and the man who was to replace him, Oliver Cromwell. Manchester went urged by the left, if you like, the resolute offensive, destroying the royal armies, etc., etc., said, though we are forced to fight against him, remember, in the eyes of God, he is still our king. That's the Presbyterian line, the conservative, you see, of the revolutionary side in a sense, but the most conservative part of Cromwell's answer, which is beautifully brief, was this. If that be so, my lord, we should never have taken up arms at first. Right? Now the conflict, you see, between these forces led to the elimination, effectively, of Presbyterian control. How did this happen? It happened because as a result of military necessity, they were compelled to consent to the formation of and to denounce the new model army. Now the new model army was entirely, in one sense or another, composed of independents, Baptists, etc., etc. And when you look at it in social terms, it was composed of relatively poor men, small property owners. Another of Cromwell's short and effective epigrams, when he was criticised for not promoting certain people who, by reason of their social status, title, and so on, replied, give me a plain man who knows what he fights for rather than he that you call a gentleman. Now, you see, I'm trying to convey the social tensions on the parliamentary side. Right, the outcome was then, bourgeois revolution, bourgeoisie itself, what a compromise this does. The break leading to 1649, effectively the army fought the break. Now we're used to thinking of armies as reactionary. The army was, if you like, the political party of the independents. It represented the most dynamic, the most forward-looking people, the people who wanted to push it through. In order to do this, we're having conflict. A conflict about a whole number of things, but since, as I say, I'm brutally short in the course of events, decisive question, what happens to the monarch? Well, that Charles has to go was not a matter of dissent for anyone on this point. But when Charles goes, what happens? Well, young Charles, his son, basically, will be king on our terms. You know, total contract and so on. Whereas, under the pressure of the ranks, the peddlers, and so forth, the independent leadership, the generals, decided to make an issue of monarchy as such. Again, in Cromwell's immortal words, that man of blood, Charles Stuart, must die. Why? Charles is a prisoner by this time. The army for the war in the world. For a very simple reason, it's a question of ideology. You see, the traditional notion, the king is, the Lord's anointed, right, so on and so forth, and therefore whatever he does as an individual, he, the institution, right, is divinely ordained, cannot be altered, and so on and so forth. It's precisely to break that.
But Charles was put on trial, and there was never any doubt about the verdict. It wasn't. The judge had been careless, left him, and had his head cut off. For what? And this was the final insult. What treason? Now then, the problem starts. It turned out that the forces that had been relatively united in 1640, much less so by 1644-45, were after 1649 profoundly divided. That is to say, a coherent bourgeois force which could pull behind it the great majority of the people who objectively, one might say, could be expected to be behind it, did not emerge. Consequently, series of things, you know, the Long Parliament is purged. I'm fond of quoting Cromwell, aren't I? I think that's all right, it's down, but I mean, he expresses public confidence, and I can. He comes in with a file of musketeers and says, no, it's a revelation, it doesn't matter. And then, you have sat here too long for any good you'd be doing. In the name of God, go! And since he had a file of musketeers behind him. But then that creates a problem. You see, here you have the force carrying through a bourgeois revolution. So now, to a certain extent, against the bourgeoisie, without the effective political support of the bourgeoisie. What was left was a parliament that dominated the independent state. But they too proved too conservative in the ranks of the new model army and so on. They too had to be disposed of. I don't mean physically, they had to be dispersed and so on. At the end of the day, the regime was reduced to a military dictatorship ruled by the major generals. Now, this shows us a central problem with any bourgeois revolution. Because one was the first, it shows it particularly clearly. And unless you understand this, it's impossible to understand why there was a restoration and why there was a second revolution. It is this. And this time I'll quote a royalist. We have two problems. One is the problem of establishing what we would say in our terms is a regime, a set of institutions, a government and a legal system which facilitate the process of capital accumulation. Yes. On the other hand, you've got the problem of doing this by force. There's no question that the old regime could be overthrown peacefully without encouraging too much, and at the same time controlling what the royalist historian Clarendon called dirty people of no name. Really? Not beggars. Not proletarians, but meaning precisely the mass of small property owners. You see, we, with the great benefit of hindsight, know what the fate of these people was. They were to be amongst the principal victims of the regime as it was subsequently established. Now, Cromwell had been reduced to military rule. If all we can say, it's a sort of proto-Bonaparte. Again, we shouldn't forget the differences. Cromwell isn't thinking these terms. Cromwell's convinced Calvinist, thought in terms of inspiration and so on, according to Hill's biography, when puzzled, when troubled, as he would put it. It was his habit to consult the Bible, opening it at random, and surprise, surprise, he usually managed to find a passage which told him what he wanted to do. But then, you see, this is not hypocrisy. You see what I mean? The later bourgeois revolutions are different in the sense that this sort of ideological conviction is gone. Now you have a problem. What happens? As long as Cromwell lived, he was able, because he was established, because he enjoyed, in spite of everything, in spite of the purge of the levellers, in spite of the attempt conquest of Ireland and so on, a very broad layer of support, and because he was able, the regime managed to keep going precariously, but it kept going. When he died, it fell to pieces. It fell to pieces. And consequently, what is the fear in the minds of the larger property owners, Presbyterian as well as royalists, it is we need the strong arm. So they brought back the exile, James Charles II, who had been, of course, an exile chasing around European courts since, 1649, or early 1648 or something. Okay. There you go. Let's be clear about this, too. It was not the royalists who brought him back, right? They arranged a parliamentary election, right? that is to say that the clique of generals arranged the parliamentary election, since they arranged it, it produced the result that they wanted, namely a parliament dominated by Presbyterians, because they were becoming more conservative, with an independent minority, and a view, as we would say now, token royalists. It was the Presbyterians who invited Charles back, and they invited him back, as they thought, on terms. In fact, of course, that enormous shift in the balance of forces led to almost the disbandment of the army. The army must be got rid of, one pretext or another. Then, of course, the re-emergence of the return of the royalist exiles, the upsurge of the most backward elements in the country, which at that time, best of all, and so on, shifted the balance of forces. And consequently, just as the Cromwellian regime had proved to be unstable, so the Restoration itself proved to be an unstable compromise. It lasted a surprisingly long time. And here it lasted actually until 1688, but effectively until it enjoyed the support, grudging, but nevertheless of the majority of the big provincials until 1683. Here we have an accident of history, the rule of the great man. Actually, we analyse all these things in terms of social forces, but this does not mean that individuals placed in particular situations do not play a significant role, and in certain circumstances, for a time, a temporarily decisive role. Such a man was Cromwell, such a man, curiously enough, although he was in terms of personal character and everything else, the absolute opposite of Cromwell was Charles II. Charles II, paradoxically, was the least enthusiastic of all the people on the royalist side for the royalist reaction. Don't misunderstand me. He wanted it, but he wanted also a bit of time and suffering. He said this, people urged him, you know, do this, that and the other, push it harder to the right. We've got to get back to 1639 and so on. He said, I early resolved and have never wavered from one conviction. I will not go on my travels again. In other words, a new civil war and a new exile is to be avoided at all costs. It's possible for him to do this for a number of reasons, not simply his personality, but one that relates to foreign affairs, which I'll have to talk about briefly in a moment. But first, let me say this. That unstable compromise lasted as long as it did only because of the policy, right, of, it's very difficult for monarchists, you see, to simply buck to the monarch, you know, but for the policies of Charles II, and his personal character. He was a very idle man, very frivolous, at the same time very clever. When he was succeeded by a more convinced monarchist, his brother James, the thing fell to pieces very quickly. Fell to pieces. But hang on, we have said, haven't we, the great problem with the bourgeois revolution, this one illustrates very, very clearly, is that, yes, you can overthrow the regime, but what then? We've got to have a stable ruling class, a stable state, and for all the time, the mean and dirty people of no name. Hence, we go to foreign affairs. Because, actually, although 1688 was made in a sense by the, was the wish, to a certain extent, was made by the people who subsequently become the Whigs, the Whig oligarchy, the instrument was a foreigner and a foreign army. How is this possible? I want to talk about foreign affairs quickly in terms of four countries. Four countries. The United Netherlands, the Dutch, France, under Louis XIV, Scotland, that might surprise you, and Ireland, the Dutch. The Dutch were, of course, the commercial rivals of the English bourgeoisie. Right? There was no love of Dutchmen in those circles. At the same time, remember the international role of the papacy? The United Netherlands was a barrier to the expansion of France. The series of wars, the invasion of the Flanders, and so on and so forth. And the crushing of the Dutch Republic, if you happen, represents two things which were not at all to the taste of great merchants and the capitalist landlords in Britain. One was the expansion of the power of France, then the dominant power in Europe, and clearly the rival to God. Second, it would be a victory. This is termed in practice in political terms for the Sanhedrin, the quasi, the battle. Neither would say what. Neither would say what is called external and internal issues. Consequently, look at the problem. How do we get a new Cromwell? I mean, I don't suggest that each individual thought about in these precise terms, but how do we get a new Cromwell who, what, can have or can have manufactured for him some type of legitimacy, right? Very important, this, for killing the masses. Two, having found him, how do we get him here? How do we install him? First thing is very simple. Again, role of accidents in history. Well, not entirely accidents, but still never by large accidents. For diplomatic reasons, earlier, William, remember this is a republic, he was the, what did you say in Dutch? The staff officer in Germany, right? That is to say, he was equivalent to an American president. I mean, that's it. The thing is not exact, but right? He did not have a hereditary title, even though the last rulership had been in his family for some generations, right? And so on. He was a Dutchman. He was wholly committed to the struggle against France, above all, right? Because the safety of the Republic depended upon it. And he was able to be flexible, and he had married, as I said, for diplomatic reasons, the daughter, the elder daughter of James II. Now, she had claimed, since Charles II was dead and Charles I had his head cut off, to have, in a certain sense, the Stuart succession rights. And she was, in all accounts, according to Macaulay, a very amiable lady, but wholly under her husband's thumb. Right? Therefore, he's an excellent candidate. The problem having this, now we're getting there. It involves two things. It involves the uniting a conspiracy, because remember, treason, of your sources have, sections, all the major sections of the big property owners, including those who have been royalists, providing they're not ultra royalists. Why? Because if it's divided, if there's a new civil conflict, the mean and dirty people are here again, we might have a new model army, and God save us from that. Therefore, it involves territorial connections, prominent Tory politicians, the term of William Tory came into use about this, including people who held office under Charles II, including people who had erst the branding, raised the brand on the face, and licking their ears off, slitting nose, and so on, for persistent heretical opinions, including these people. Well, the main thing was that the Whigs, again, the Whig section of Parliament, different in outcome, a conspiracy, and finally, it needed actions by the government to convince the property-owning classes as a whole that they were not safe under the regime. That James would not, in fact, accept the existing compromise, even though it had been pushed far to the right, he wouldn't accept it. In particular, he was determined to re-establish Popery, as they call it. Why? Again, you have to look at the connection between ideology and interest. Popery has absolute monarchy in France, absolute monarchy in Spain, etc. The Austrian Empire, backwardness, quasi-feudal conditions, and so on and so forth. But it was also matters almost established that it was necessary for James to convey undoubted property rights. That is to say, he did those things. Measures against the Church of England. He imposed the Roman Catholic both positions and so on, quite contrary to the law, you know, mind the law. With it. He was trying at the same time to raise an Irish army. I can talk, let's talk about Ireland a bit, I'll come back to it in a moment. And for this, he needed money. He was getting some money from Louis XIV, so he wasn't as well. And therefore, he was compelled to trespass on what they were most concerned about. Right? Most concerned about. Sacredness and cultural rights. The coincidence of these two things. Oh, here is an event brought going to try with seven bishops, Church of England bishops, Tories to a man, ask yourself who the point of them, and so on, convinced the property classes that yes, there has to be a break. Prominent group, secretly, any negotiations and so on, invite William to come, but with an army. That army had to be composed of foreigners. The Scots were going to be foreigners at the time, right? Scots mercenaries from Europe. It had to be foreign, and it had to be mercenary. That is to say, it had to fight to pay and nothing else, so that it could be got paid off as soon as they think it all. Hence, we come back to William sailing down the channel, pursued by the English fleet, didn't manage to capture him, landing at Torbay. What happens then is fantastically interesting, but I haven't really time to go into it very much. It is this. James, on paper, has a superior force. I mean, observe the numbers and so on and so forth. At very least, you would think there must be a great deal of fighting. Don't you believe? There was any. As William advanced, not very rapidly, by the way, there was calculation in this. General Director, Watson, Thames Valley, North of London. So James's forces assembled to oppose him started to disintegrate. Why? Because their officer corps, at the end of the day, is drawn from the property classes and shares the concerns of the property classes. I can illustrate this only by one well-known example. A man called John Churchill, founder of the family's fortunes. Had a very varied career. He made his way, first of all, because his sister had been a mistress of James. He had made his career by, as Macaulay says, a series of well-timed treasons. In this case, it was most important, first of all, in convincing James, who was a professional soldier, that he was thoroughly loyal and reliable. Second, that James was surrounded by traitors. Therefore, he had to follow Churchill's advice. And finally, in the time to introduce complete confusion of the Royal Army, until the scale of desertions became such that James was convinced he would be better to fight, fled first to London and then ultimately overseas. Now, let us look at this briefly to regular. James has fled. The Royalist authorities in London are concerned above all about what? Is that a reputation? Really, I think Oxford says, leave, come quickly. Come quickly. Does he even think we're supposed to be fighting again? But again, you look at the coincidence of class interests, the fact, the need to establish a stable government. It was established. William, they couldn't actually make king by himself, so that's why it's William and Mary. He had their hereditary title, he had no title to the thing. Let us look what the changes have then ensued. I'll deal with them briefly, but they are fundamentally important. What really was changed in 1688, and changed, as it turns out, permanently? First, the monarchy, in the sense that James the First and Charles the First had understood monarchy, had gone. What was William's title? A parliament, a vote in the House of Commons. That, and the fact that they needed it. Now, actually, in which he quotes a dispatch sent by the French ambassador from London to Edmund in Paris, Louis, saying, although the form of monarchy subsists, in truth, this is a republic. And he was, in essence, right. He was much shrewder than some modern historians. In essence, that is right. William's position in England, William's position in England is essentially not different from that of the Netherlands. He had to rule in collaboration with the existing ruling classes. He could not rule against them. He had no organization to rule. That's the fundamental thing. And therefore, what was within Julian nature, nevertheless, was established as the ruling class in a coherent sense. Wait, in the bourgeoisie. You look at the composition of the parliaments under William III, as a matter of fact, right through to the first half of the 19th century. The vast majority of members of parliament are landowners. Yeah? Only a minority are merchants, taxers, etc. Yes. Important to realise, you see, that represented, he thinks Thompson very forcefully and correctly argued, a landowning class, but in no sense a feudal landowning class, an anti-feudal landowning class, a capitalist landowning class devoted to doing what? To agricultural improvements, accumulate, accumulate, and so on. Thompson has a lovely phrase, polemic, polemic, in which he says, how did the 18th century, that's a few years later, landowners view themselves? How did they measure their worth with respect to one another? By their titles? No. Oh, what titles are they? No. By the size of their rent rolls. You see, essentially, a thoroughly bourgeois regime. Bourgeois, not in the sense that the majority of the people who ruled were technically members of the bourgeoisie, but their support represented on the essential bourgeois classes committed to war and capital accumulation. A stable ruling class. Secondly, and this is equally important, the guarantee of property rights.
Don't call Bill of Rights and so
on. That involved changing the judiciary, of course. Imposed because the judiciary until that time has been appointed actually by the king, somebody appointed to do it, and were subject to dismissal and so on. Absolute guarantees of property rights and independence of the judiciary. Independence meant independence of the government, not independence of the bourgeois landowning class. Not only that, but personal safety. Remember, in the whole period between 1640 and 1688, leading opposition people were apt to end up on the scaffold. Not only on the scaffold, they were convicted of high treason. Not only on the scaffold, conviction for high treason involved automatically the confiscation of all property.
So the family's lost as well. Hence, you know, John put it, speaking of this aspect of the matter,
prior to the revolution, by which you meant 88,
not 40,
a state trial, i.e. a treason trial, was merely a murder preceded by a certain amount of money.
That's what the judgment said.
Right? That had to be got rid of. The personal safety of the members of the ruling class. There is an analogy here, of course. This is what Khrushchev established, right, with regard to the Stalinist ruling class after the beginning of the Stalinization. Third, the domination of the rest of the United Kingdom, indeed the establishment of the United Kingdom, although it did not become technically that until, what, 1708, and the expense of the other parts of the United Kingdom. This involved Scotland and Ireland. In the case of Scotland, we can be brief. It was a very poor, very backward, and very turbulent country. Poverty we can measure as follows. In the last years of Charles II, the Crown's income from customs dues and customary taxes, etc., etc., from England alone was £1.25 billion. But of course, currency values have been totally transferred. From the entire Kingdom of Scotland, which has legally settled, right? The king is the king of both. £60,000. And, as one of their historians said, he was ruled by an aristocracy which, quote, was the poorest, the proudest, the most unscrupulous, and the most mercenary in Europe. Consequently, power in England meant that domination of Scotland was easy, did not require a thoroughgoing transformation, or left a built-in problem. Not against Stuart uprisings. Money was sufficient. Ireland is a very different case. The case of Ireland, you see, leave aside the previous plantations and so forth, James had sought to upset the settlement, Protestant settlement in Ireland. He had sought to upset it, not incidentally because he loved the Irish, he was as bigoted and had the Irish as any of us, but because the course of the Reformation had left the mass of the peasantry in Ireland papist, and therefore potentially the potential for an army or counter-revolution, which he tried to see. When he fled from England, he ultimately made his way back to French fleet the storm to Ireland. There was a awful period, you know, back of the mind, 1690, that's where he's sitting on his horse. The outcome was the destruction, the final destruction of the old order in Ireland. Of course, it had been heavily eroded, the Elizabethan settlements, Cromwell's conquest, undertakings, you know, to dampen down the radicalism of the new model army and to get them as far away as possible. But nevertheless, the old order was still vital. It was destroyed. The old Irish problem was destroyed. I bet it was. And
finally, of course, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of Europe, a regime was created which could be guaranteed to be resolutely anti-French. This is what's the main motivation.
Why? Because of the maritime powers the Dutch were now trading. They were in any case locked in struggle with France. France, the enemy of the future. I said at the beginning, right now, near the beginning. Look here, the settlement that lasted 150 years. Conquest of India in competition with the French. The conquest of North America in competition with the French. What's it all about? It's not about territory as such, it's about capital accumulation. Hence, the whole 18th century tradition. Thus, 1688 represents the final completion, stabilisation of the English Revolution, and it represented it in the most conservative form possible, consistent with the establishment of a stable bourgeois regime. 1688, therefore, does matter. Amongst other things, it's why we still have a monarchy.